Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming to our third 3CL Trevor Smith Lunchtime Seminar. And delighted to introduce Professor David Zaring, who some of you will already know. David is Associate Professor of Legal Studies and Business Ethics at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's been since 2008. And he's currently based here at Cambridge this term, where he's teaching International Financial Regulation on the NCL, some of you will know. David has formerly worked as an attorney at the US Department of Justice. He's also held teacher positions at NYU School of Law and also Washington and Lee School of Law. He's a slightly strange animal insofar as, even though he's based to a large extent in the corporate and financial law domain, he is, by specialism, principally an international administrative lawyer, which is probably why his services and expertise are in such high demand. Amongst other things, David writes a regular column for the New York Times. He also writes for the Washington Post, so very much a celebrity academic. He is in a similar guise. He is appearing next week before the House Financial Services Committee at Congress in Washington, D.C., if indeed Washington, D.C. still standing next week. And David's also previously appeared before the same committee to give evidence. The title of David's presentation today is Regulation by Threat, Understanding Dodd-Frank's Regulation of Systemically Significant Non-Bank Financial Companies. So, over to David.
Okay, well, thanks, Mark, and thank you all for coming. I'm delighted to be here and to be able to talk about this paper that I'm doing with Daniel Schwartz. Hopefully it will strike you all as related enough to the questions that corporate and commercial lawyers need to think about, though really this is a paper about regulation. And in particular, it's a paper that takes a sort of position on a form of regulation that the United States has adopted in the wake of the financial crisis. And that is the regulation of financial companies that are thought to be systemically risky, but that are not banks. And what the United States has done is created a sort of council of regulators that are meant to subject some of these firms, but not all of them, to extra supervision by the Federal Reserve. And it's that designation process that's proven to be quite controversial, and it is something that firms that are could be subject to financial regulation have taken great steps to avoid. And so kind of what I want to talk about is what do we make of a regulatory system that works the way the American one has worked, and what can we think about it as an example of a way to oversee the financial sector for systemic stability? So that's the goal. This is the problem, and the problem is that you can see that General Electric Capital, a firm that had a savings and loan charter, which is a kind of bank charter that no longer exists in the United States, was designated as systemically significant by American regulators and subjected to extra supervision by the Federal Reserve Board, the nation's most prominent banking regulator. And in order to get out of that designation, General Electric Capital completely transformed itself. So you can see it shrank the company as a matter of assets, and in particular, it got rid of any kinds of assets that it thought were runnable or that had proven to be subject to runs during the financial crisis. So deposits, because depositors can leave and withdraw their money at any point. Commercial paper, because every so often the market for commercial paper will dry up, as it did in the wake of the financial crisis. And securitizations, which is one of two ways in which the insurance company AIG got into trouble during the financial crisis. Another company, MetLife, the second largest insurer in the world, sued, and so far has sued successfully to reduce its designation. So there's the cute blimp. MetLife advertises by flying around football and baseball games in a blimp. The financial regulator, it was thought, sort of shot it down by designating it as a financial institution. This process of identifying a few very large American non-bank financial firms and subjecting them to extra oversight has come subject to a great deal of criticism. For example, there's been concern expressed by Congress itself as to whether there's data behind the Council's decisions to designate firms as systemically significant. The Republican Party has vowed to reduce or reverse this process of systemic regulation through designation. And a court has recently ruled that the designation of MetLife itself was arbitrary and capricious as a matter of administrative law and not supported by a cost-benefit analysis, which the court concluded was required, or indeed a sort of adversarial process whereby the firm MetLife could come in and make a case to the council that the designation was inappropriate. Instead, there was this sort of back and forth that the court thought was not the kind of thing that you'd expect if you're getting fair administrative procedure. So some of the critics have suggested that this whole process is something like a Hotel California. FSOC designates you, you check in, but you can never leave. In the words of the Eagles. And the only two institutions that have been able to leave are MetLife so far through litigation and General Electric, which completely had to transform itself, not the industrial firm, which still does what General Electric does, but the financing arm has been spun off and radically transformed in an effort to get out of designation. Okay, so the question is that a legitimate form of regulation, and what can we learn about the way it works? And to be clear, my co-author and I are have a real thumb on the scale on this. We have filed briefs defending the government and litigation involving the MetLife case, and this article does something similar, and that's what my testimony will do next week. We think that the way that the United States has changed in the wake of the financial crisis and tried to do something about the risks posed by non-bank financial firms is defensible. And the reason we do think that is because we think that systemic risk remains something that's rather unpredictable. And therefore, a cost-benefit analysis or a precise inquiry into who exactly is risky and who exactly is not, we think is impossible. And so instead of trying to undertake that exercise between parsing between the country's largest insurance firms, for example, and passing some as safe and others as potentially unsafe, we think that the model that American regulators have chosen, which is to subject a few large firms to a lot of supervision in an effort to persuade the rest to look out for taking on systemic risk on their own parts, is an appropriate method of regulation. And as you'll hear at the end of the talk, I think there are other reasons why we might find what the council is doing to be legitimate. Okay, so what are the academic contributions other than just being on team FSOC, as the Financial Stability Oversight Council is called? Again, first of all, we think that it's just interesting that financial stability is not yet science, even though it is all about looking at balance sheets and doing math. And then secondly, we want to defend the idea that a regulator could threaten a firm with regulation, painful supervision, and that that wouldn't be arbitrary regulation, but that it would count as a form of appropriate regulation. And so we think we can defend the idea that the threat of regulation, which sounds on the face of it to be an arbitrary kind of exercise of government power, can be appropriate. And it's particularly appropriate when the knowledge of what exactly works and what the best way to regulate is limited, and that the possibility of catastrophe is large. And we think that's a heuristic that fits financial regulation, and it's also worth noting that it's a heuristic that represents the precautionary principle, which some European regulators have thought appropriate in other contexts. Okay, so before I talk more about that, that's sort of the overview. I wanted to give you just a brief history of the problem and how the council became the administrative body that it is. So first of all, the financial crisis was resolved by the government through a series of deals and bailouts. And one of the things that is most notable about the financial crisis in the United States was that many of the firms that fell or just about fell and required a bailout or some sort of investment by the government were not banks, who were the only firms regulated for systemic risk before the crisis. So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were semi-government-owned mortgage securitizers, both required bailouts. The largest insurance company in the United States required a bailout, and some banks also required bailouts, like Citigroup, Bank of America, and Wachovia. But Bear Stearns was an investment bank and a broker-dealer, and not subject to systemic supervision by the Federal Reserve. And Washington Mutual was a so-called thrift, or a bank that used to be involved in housing finance, and it also was not subject to supervision by the Federal Reserve. And nonetheless, all of these financial institutions required government support during the financial crisis. So the question was how to stop that from happening again. And the American regulatory response, of legislative response, is the so-called Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act. There's Senator Christopher Dodd, and there's Representative Barney Frank. They shepherded it through Congress, and you can see that it was signed by the president in 2010. What Dodd-Frank did was take, I feel like I'm just, did I sweep past a slide there? I don't know. What Dodd-Frank did was it said, instead of regulating non-bank financial institutions in a particular way, we're going to create a council of regulators, the Financial Stability Oversight Council, most of our existing regulators, and give them a number of statutory standards that they should apply to all non-bank financial firms, and use those standards to incentivize the financial institutions from taking on risk, or if they do have risk, to empower the council to subject them to regulation by the Federal Reserve to reduce that risk. So the Dodd-Frank statute was extremely long, and in some ways going through the precise language that Congress did isn't too rewarding, but it's worth noting that what you have with the sort of multi-factor test that Congress announced is the kind of word salad, lots of possible ways that a regulator could regulate without a lot of regulatory constraints, especially if you look at subsection K of the Congress's guidance to council, which lets the council take any other risk-related factors that the council deems appropriate into consideration when deciding whether to designate an institution as risky or not. So the council tried to interpret these statutes in a way that would focus on particular dimensions of non-bank financial firms to see whether they were systemically risky. And the most important factor it focused on, and one it was required to look at by the statute, is the size of the institution. But it also looked for evidence that the financial institution would create real problems in the larger economy or for the rest of the financial economy if the financial institution failed. So FSOC looks for substitutability. If this firm stopped operating, could another firm take its place? And interconnectedness. If this firm failed to make good on its contracts or positions, would other financial firms, or what quantum of the financial sector would be affected by that? It also looked at the kind of things that bank regulators often look at when they're supervising banks, such as how leveraged the institution was, how liquid its assets were in case it needed to obtain a bunch of assets in a hurry. And then it also asked whether the financial institution was, as a matter of current practice, well supervised by a regulator. So this is different from FSOC's supervision of banks, but just so you know, FSOC has said that all American banks over $50 billion are subject to systemic extra supervision by the Federal Reserve. And some of those banks have been designated as internationally risky by the Financial Stability Board, which is a network of regulators, including American regulators, European regulators, and financial regulators from the G20 more generally. For non-banks, the council ultimately decided to designate four as systemically risky. So I talked a little bit about General Electric Capital. And then it also designated the three largest American insurance companies, AIG, MetLife, and Prudential Financial, as systemically significant. So what that meant is that these four firms were subject to extra attention by the Federal Reserve, and that the rest of the financial economy, other than banks, was not. So that meant that, for example, All the other insurance companies within the jurisdiction of the United States were not designated for this extra attention. And some of those insurance companies were very large, including Berkshire Hathaway. That's the firm that Warren Buffett owns, that owns a couple of very large insurance companies and a few very large reinsurance companies. Nonetheless, they were not designated as systemically significant. And so you can see in the sense in which the Financial Stability Oversight Council chose to designate some insurers, but only three in the end. It also stayed out of some sectors of the non-bank financial economy. So an example of that would be asset managers, such as BlackRock and Vanguard. So these are institutions that basically hold money for any reason, but often for retirement. And they are increasingly huge as a matter of assets under management in the American economy. And indeed, the Office of Financial Research in the United States has investigated whether these institutions, in particular the largest of them, like BlackRock and Vanguard, ought to be subject to financial regulators because basically, the number of $4.10 trillion sounds like a lot of money. So far, FSOC has said no, but it has considered whether asset managers should be designated as risky. Also designated as risky were financial market utilities, just so you know, stock exchanges and clearinghouses. And we're not talking about those in this process because they haven't grieved about the kind of way that FSOC operates in making their designations the way that asset managers and insurance companies have. Okay. So I've talked to you a little bit about the way the process works. What I want to do now is talk a little bit about why we think it's an appropriate way for financial regulation to be done. And some of the sort of implications of the fact of the way it is done. But hopefully you have a sense on what's going on. We have a jerry-rigged system where America's financial regulators, rather than being combined under the one agency, have been told to work together to identify risky firms that aren't already under supervision. So then taking that role seriously, the council has decided to designate these four firms as risky. And in one case, General Electric Capital, it rescinded that designation 2 years afterwards. Okay, so what's good about this process? Why do we think that it's an appropriate way to deal with the problem posed by, during the financial crisis, AIG, which required an enormous bailout and was a terrible burden on the Treasury Department, or at least was until they sold it off its shares at a profit? Okay, well, I've suggested some of the reasons why we think it's appropriate. First of all, we think that systemic risk is uncertain. One of the things that was learned during the financial crisis is that we don't know which part of the financial economy is going to be the part that poses risks. That means that regulators are unlikely to be able to predict to us fairly well in advance which firm is supposed to be systemically risky and which firm won't be. And of course, this isn't just the case with regulators. Investors also don't know whether a bank is going to be sound or unsound in the wake, in the run-up to a financial crisis. Or at least they didn't during the last financial crisis, when Lehman Brothers was considered to be adequately capitalized and investors had some inkling that something was wrong, but nonetheless, its shares dropped in value dramatically over the course of a weekend when the financial firm ultimately failed. So where you have the uncertainty of where risk can arise in a financial system, combined with an inability to identify with any sort of precision what counts as risky market conduct, then an uncertain process that can subject firms to painful regulation but does not have to do so, we think incentivizes firms to not seek out systemic risk. And if they don't have that kind of incentive, then they can seek out systemic risk and hope to be bailed out by the government if their risky bets run awry. So in an uncertain context, an uncertain regulatory process is, in our view, appropriate or can be considered to be an appropriate way to solve a problem posed by regulation. Okay. Secondly, as I've suggested, the malleability of the designation process, whereby the council looks at a number of different factors but can weigh those factors independently and has refused to say precisely what goes into constituting systemic risk by a firm, is exactly the kind of message that we might think appropriate to send to insurance companies, asset managers, money market funds, and the other institutions that aren't banks, but that nonetheless pose threats to the financial system. Moreover, and I'll talk about this a little more later in the talk, we think the uncertainty isn't so high because of the way that the screening process works. And then finally, FSOC designation doesn't just discipline firms, it also disciplines regulators. Because the council has said that if a firm is underregulated, then it will subject that firm to supervision by the Federal Reserve. This threat has incentivized regulators to do a better job of managing systemic risk in their own issue areas. And an example of this might be seen by the SEC's grudging willingness to regulate money market funds in a new way. So money market funds were regulated by the SEC. During the financial crisis, one of them failed. It broke the buck. Ever since then, there's been a concern that the SEC would fail to do something about the riskiness of these non-bank, or shadow banks, if you like, but bank-like institutions. And the SEC eventually did pass a rule re-regulating money market funds, but it only did so after members of the financial FSOC said that if the SEC didn't regulate, they were very likely to do so. Okay, so those are some advantages of the process. Secondly, we think that in general, it's possible to defend the idea of supervising financial firms with threatened regulation. For starters, agencies can't regulate everybody. And secondly, it's not a defense to the use of regulation to say, but that other guy wasn't regulated. So as a matter of law, we think it's defensible to have regulation of some financial institutions like insurance companies, but not all of them. And we think that sort of precautionary style regulation is particularly appropriate when uncertainty is high and downside risk is extreme. And then finally, the way that FSOC regulates has some advantages based on the way that it does, based on the way that it acts. So, for example, one of the things that the council has to do before it decides whether to regulate a firm is systemically significant is vote on that designation. So that vote means that every member of the council, every American regulator has to cast a vote, and that vote is public. There are some reasons to believe that that's an appropriate regulatory process. Another thing that the council does is include a number of members that aren't usually included in the project of federal financial regulation. So the United States is made up of the federal government and the 50 states, and state members participate in the council's designation process. Finally, as you saw, or as you may have seen, the council plays a role in what's increasingly an international process of financial regulation, which I think, sometimes I can talk your ear off about some other papers I've written about this, constrains domestic regulators in what they can or cannot do. So even though the council has the ability to select some firms for designation and can omit other firms from designation, it can't give up on the process of regulation because it's a member of the Financial Stability Board, which has designated some American financial firms as risky and subject to international supervision, and encouraged American regulators to subject those institutions to supervision as well. And finally, the council has some degree of political accountability. American regulators are often thought to be very removed from political oversight by the president. And in many cases, that's correct. The regulators are hard to reach by elected officials. Sometimes they're not even subject to budget appropriations by Congress, as is the case with the Federal Reserve. But the Financial Stability Oversight Council has it chaired by the Secretary of the Treasury. And the President appoints the Secretary and can remove the Secretary for any reason, good or bad. That political accountability, we think, adds to the legitimacy of the Council. And if you'll excuse me for going back through my slides, I thought I had a diagram of the agency, but okay. Okay, well, maybe I'll wrap up, and then you can tell me if any of this didn't make sense or what your observations are as to whether any questions you like. I welcome them all. Okay, so so you've heard from us the case about why the council does a good job. And I want to identify some caveats and some further issues that hopefully mean that this is not just a question of what's the right way for Americans to think about regulating insurance companies. We hope that what we suggest is that there may be some cases in which threats of regulation might be thought of as legitimate kinds of regulation. And then secondly, we think that, and this is, we think, interesting, that a regulatory impact analysis, or in the United States as it's often called, cost-benefit regulation, it's often held up to be the gold standard of the decision for when the government should act and when it shouldn't. But we think that this gold standard kind of regulation is inappropriate in when it comes to financial stability. And it's interesting that this is the approach that the American financial regulators have taken. So they have refused to elaborate exactly a formula that would be applied to a balance sheet to suggest when an institution is too risky. That's sort of surprising because balance sheets are, of course, comprised of numbers. And on top of that, the standard way of regulating a bank, the bottom line of financial regulation of banks, is often exactly just as such a balance sheet exercise. So the third iteration of the Basel Capital Accord subjects internationally active banks to a number of capital adequacy ratios, which are very precise formulas that the banks will know about in advance. So for example, a 3% leverage measure of tier one capital to total assets. Or a net stable funding ratio to ensure that long-term assets held by the bank are matched with long-term liabilities. Or there's the capital ratio itself, Basel III, which requires roughly, circa 8%, give or take, tier one plus tier two capital, plus additional capital surcharges, which are spelled out by the Basel Committee banking process. So all of that is regulation by number. And what's interesting about what the financial regulation, the Financial Stability Oversight Council has done with non-banks is it has rejected this idea that regulation by number is the right or only way to do financial regulation of companies like insurance companies. Instead, it said, we're going to look at a ton of different factors, and we're not exactly going to identify which factors are important in advance, and we are not going to justify the decisions we make by establishing that the benefits to the economy outweigh the costs to the financial institution or the economy of designation. And that we think is interesting because cost-benefit analysis is often held up to be a gold standard of regulation in any jurisdiction and a discipline on regulatory overreach. And it's one that has been rejected in this case, and we think appropriately so. Okay. Secondly, one of the things that makes our case, I think, sort of more difficult is that as a matter of history, insurance companies do not look like the riskiest firms that you can imagine. In many ways, the simple case for regulating insurance companies as systemically risky sort of goes like this. Look at AIG. That's it. Right? It's the only insurance company, at least in the United States, that failed during the financial crisis. And it failed because it was engaged in a risky form of insurance as well as a super safe form of insurance. And that is that it wrote credit default swaps that were unhedged and that could have gone against it in the face of a general downturn of the credit ratings of the institutions that it insured. And during the financial crisis, that general downgrade in the credit ratings of those institutions happened. But life insurance companies aren't so subject to runnable systemic risk, right? Unless everybody dies all at once. But the whole point is that that's the least of your worries, is how unstable your insurance company is. And ditto, with the case of property insurance and that kind of thing. It should be non-runnable and not subject to liquidity or solvency problems if the insurance company is adequately prepared to survive one hurricane somewhere. But there's an unlikely to be a risk of five hurricanes. And so nonetheless, we're willing to defend the regulation of insurance companies as systemically risky, largely on the basis, as I've told you, that there is real uncertainty as to where the next sort of risk could come from. And before the financial crisis, nobody thought that AIG was a risky insurance company. Instead, it was renowned for its risk management practices. And because companies that become so big and so important to our financial economy can pose the kinds of risks that cause real damage to it, we're willing to defend that choice. But other people think that insurance companies or asset managers, though they may be enormous, couldn't possibly represent the kind of risk that a bank might represent. Okay. And finally, my co-author and I are generally no fans of regulating through the precautionary principle. And nonetheless, we're defending an example of something like the precautionary principle here, which is we are defending the right of regulators to be able to reject regulation in cases not where they know that the regulated industry is doing something risky, but rather where they don't know whether the regulated industry is doing something risky. And we think that that's appropriate in financial regulation because of the difficulties of knowing where risk will come from and the costs of a financial crisis. But it's worth saying that that's a relatively controversial approach to regulation. Okay, and with that, I'd welcome and look forward to your questions. You can email me, and the draft is available on SSRN if you want to take a look.